Now I want to talk to you about the future and changing the future and improving the future. But before we do, let me tell you something about myself. I am to economics what wood rot is to Pinocchio, what the ivory trade is to Dumbo. I've read a few economic texts and tracts in my time, and I couldn't really make head nor tail of them. So I approached our next guest, but with some degree of caution and trepidation. I shouldn't have, because he's an amazing, uplifting, enthusiastic and energetic look at how we can change our economic future, not just for you and me. This isn't a get-rich-quick book. It's about mass impoverishment and how we can end it. And that's the subtitle of a book called 99%. And the author, Mark E. Thomas, joins us now on Talk Radio. Good morning, Mark. And congratulations on a fascinating and, as I've said, inspirational book. So how long has this been in the making, in your mind or in your life?
It's in total probably about 6 years since I started really thinking about these things, and 4 years in effect from starting writing the first word of the book to publication, which is next Thursday.
Now, the subtitle is, as I said, a kind of a pretty big aim, quite a big ambition: mass impoverishment and how can we end, how we can end it. Is it possible to sum up, you know, the kind of germs of your notion, the germs of what this book's about?
It's very simple, in essence. Most people in this country are about 5% poorer than they were in 2010, but the economy as a whole is 5% richer than it was in 2010. So the pie is 5% bigger, but most people's slice has become 5% smaller. So that is what mass impoverishment is, when the pie is still growing, but your slice is shrinking. Something's going wrong for you. And if current trends continue to 2050, then the typical wage earner will be 20% poorer when they should be about 50% richer. So that's the world we should be planning for. So we need to change those trends, or we will simply find that we're not living in a civilization that we recognize.
I mean, one of the things that really hit home to me as a father and a grandfather is the fact that the next generation and the one after that may be, for the first time possibly since the Second World War in this country, be worse off than their parents.
Exactly, exactly. And that was one of the things that made me write this book, because if I think about my own family, my parents had better opportunities than their parents had had, and they ended up being better off. And I had better opportunities than had been available to my parents. And when my children were born, I took it for granted that there was a sort of law of nature that each new generation would be better off than its predecessors. And then gradually, I started to have the sense, well, that isn't quite right. And now we see that most people expect that this generation will be poorer than its parents. And as you say, that's the first time in modern history that that's happened.
And the other fascinating thing about the book for me is how this economic imbalance, call it what you will, spreads out into other things, how it can at times even be an attack, almost a frontal assault on democracy.
Well, yes, I think it can be. And, of course, it's, I don't think it's a frontal assault, though. I think it's a behind-the-scenes assault. But there are some very wealthy, very powerful people who have openly stated that they don't really believe in democracy. Some of them are free market fundamentalists, and they see democracy as a threat to the freedom of markets. They believe that free market capitalism, which is an extreme form of capitalism, is incompatible with democracy. And whereas a normal person would say, well, the conclusion from that is that we shouldn't be having that extreme form of capitalism, we should be having a balanced economy, they say, no, we have to get rid of democracy so that we can have that extreme form of free market capitalism.
Is that what you mean about that previous one, when you talk about the golden age of capitalism?
Well, the golden age of capitalism is not a term that I invented.
No.
The post-war period was hugely successful for countries all around the world, and growth rates were higher. So in the UK and the US, it was called the golden age of capitalism. Germany talked about the Wirtschaftswunder. Italy, they talked about il miracolo economico, the economic miracle. So different countries had different phrases for it, but they all had this wonderful period after the Second World War where not only was the performance of the economy good, so the pie was growing very nicely, but a normal person's slice was growing very nicely as well. in the book, I've taken that period as being from 1945 up to 1980.
Now, why is it called 99%? We are the 99% is kind of on the logo on the front.
It is, absolutely. Well, if you remember the Occupy movement in the States, Occupy Wall Street.
Oh, right, back in 2011, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it was originally. And that was one of their key slogans. And when I saw it, I remember being very struck by it. And I thought, well, actually, this is really important, isn't it? If we've got things so badly wrong, and things are worse in America than they are in the UK, we've got things so badly wrong that 99% of people are being left behind by government policy. That is economic mismanagement on an epic scale. And I thought it's such a good slogan that I would adopt it.
You'd purloin it, quite right too.
Purloin it, exactly, yes.
Now, does this mean, does this lead us into a more equal society if people have more money? Well, I was just disturbed by what you said at the beginning, when you said, you know, we may be bequeathing a world that we don't recognise to our children and grandchildren.
Absolutely.
What are the dangers then, Mark?
Well, the dangers are very simply misery for a lot of people. Life is already quite hard for a lot of people. So even something that when I was young I took for granted, that I would be able to afford to buy my own house, that is something which many, many young people don't take for granted. And if they can't buy their own house, that means they'll still be renting when they're in retirement. Not only have they not bought their own house, but also pension systems have become far less effective since I was young. So they won't have the same kind of pension that I have. So they'll still be renting, and they won't have a pension. So their prospects of actually living in any kind of dignity are dramatically reduced. There will be many, many people living either in or very, very close to what today we would call poverty, even though the economy as a whole is richer. And that's the obscene thing, that while the pie is growing, there is no excuse. There's no law that says if the pie gets 50% bigger, most people have to pay for that by having their slices shrink. No, if the pie gets 50% bigger, everybody's slice, we should be aiming for everybody's slice to get 50% bigger.
Now, I grew up in the 1960s, was a teenager in the 1970s, though, and that was an era when we still had nationalised industries in this country.
Yes.
And one of my friends, I remember very well indeed, he came from, and everybody knew, he was a railway family, and his father worked on the railway, his grandfather had, uncles and brothers did, and he went and worked on the railway when he was 16, and that was regarded then as a job for life.
Yes.
And, of course, the railways weren't regarded, they were regarded as fantastically useful, vital, but also not something that would operate at a profit. They were part of our kind of social cohesion, if you like.
Yes.
Is that where we went wrong as well, the kind of the process of denationalising so many of our basic industries?
Well, some things I think make sense to denationalise. I think that there was no real reason why an airline had to be nationally owned. On the other hand, at the other end of the spectrum, there are many, many good reasons why the NHS should not be privatised. It performs better as a nationally owned organisation, not driven by the profit motive, not split up into thousands of little subunits, each of which is independently trying to maximise its own profit, each of which is buying separately. By being a national health service, it actually performs better. On some yardsticks, even now when it's creaking at the seams because it's underperforming, it's still actually the best health service in the world. The Commonwealth Fund last year did a ranking of health services. The US system came out as just about the worst of all the developed countries, and the NHS was the best. So we need to be very careful that we don't say, well, we need to be more business-like, we need to be more like the US. That would be doubling the cost of our health services and worsening the outcomes. So there are some things where there's a natural reason for them to be nationalised. There are some other things where, actually, it really wouldn't make sense. Who would want their corner shop to be nationalised? It just wouldn't make sense. And there are some things in the middle where you have to think quite carefully to see whether it's better nationalised or privatised. But and the railways, I think, on balance, we have not seen good results from privatisation of the railways.
Now, the book is published by Head of Zeus. It's out yes. next Thursday. It's called 99%. The author is Mark E. Thomas. Without kind of giving away too much, because the book is a fascinating read, it's very accessible as well, folks. Very kind of, and I speak again as an economic illiterate, but you've outlined the problems. You've outlined where we are now, Mike. What can we do to put this right then?
There are two groups of people that have to act to put it right. Most importantly, politicians need to act to put it right, because it's politicians that have got it wrong. And there are really five things they need to do. So first of all, we need to be sure that they will not continue to implement policies that harm the 99%. So really the first thing would be to make it the constitutional duty of any elected government to govern on behalf of the 99%, not for a small and influential minority of people. Now, you might say, well, that goes without saying, and it should go without saying, but what the facts that I've uncovered in my research show is that it has been going without doing as well as going without saying, so we need to make it a constitutional duty.
I mean, what I'm fascinated by towards the end is you remind us of a phrase that Margaret Thatcher used a lot, became an acronym, TINA, there is no alternative. Yeah. And your book reminds us, actually, there are alternatives and we can all make a difference in this.
Well, that's exactly the point. So really the middle part of the book, the first part of the book looks at the problem of mass impoverishment and says, you know, this really is serious and it will get much more serious if we don't act. The middle part of the book looks at why it is we haven't been acting. And essentially, as you've just said, the reason we haven't been acting is because we've been taught to believe that there is no alternative. And many, many reasons are given for there not being any better way of running things. Virtually every one of those is not supported by the facts. And I have to say, I was quite shocked myself when I did all this research and saw quite how many of the things that politicians say with absolute conviction are simply not true at all. And other people who have read pre-publication drafts of the book have said to me that equally they were shocked. They had themselves believed a lot of these myths, and I had myself.
Well, you say that, I mean, that really resonated with me. There's a part of the book when you say you're doing all this research, you're amassing the facts, you analyse the data, and you arrive at what you believe is the truth, and I'm sure it is the truth. And then you say you'll hear a political speech which contradicts that. You know intellectually it's nonsense,
yes.
But part of you still wants to believe it. What's
going
on there, Mark?
But it did believe it, and that was very scary to me, actually, when that happened, because I read this article. One of my brothers actually sent me an article talking about the dreadful state of government finances, and this is one of the myths that I look at in the book. The truth is that our debt is not unprecedented. Our debt is actually now below the average of where it's been for the last 300 years. So it's not staggeringly high. It's not very high. It's not rather high. It's not even average. It's a little bit below average. And even when it was very, very high before the Industrial Revolution, it was about 200% of GDP. And before the golden age of capitalism, it was about 250% of GDP. That wasn't an obstacle. That didn't stop us having the Industrial Revolution, and it didn't stop us having the Golden Age. So the idea that if it somehow reached 100% now, that would cripple our children is utter nonsense. But so many people have said it so many times that I found that I half believe it myself when somebody says it. So when my brother sent me this article, I just knew that it was nonsense because I'd only recently been looking at the numbers. But I still found that there was a little bit of me that believed it. And I thought quite hard about why that might be, because it seemed odd when I, you know, was so familiar with the facts that I could still find there was part of me that believed it. And I realized that there's something in the zeitgeist. If you think about what happened after the Second World War, we did have government debt to GDP of just over 250%, which today, or in fact at any time, people would say that is staggeringly high. And we didn't say, well, this idea that Beveridge has come up with for a national health service and cradle-to-grave welfare state is a lovely idea, but it's completely impractical now. Let's shelve it for a generation until we've got debt to GDP under control. And I thought, well, how could it be that when they genuinely did have high debt to GDP, they felt they could act, We haven't, and yet we feel we can't. And I reflected on the course of the war, that at the beginning of the war, it really did look as though Britain was going to lose the war. And then after the Battle of Britain, it looked as though we might be able to hold out on the island, but obviously we didn't have the strength to do any more than that. And then once America entered the war, then the possibility that we might actually be on the winning side of the war started to happen. And then it became clear that we were winning, and then we were absolutely going to win, and then we won. So the national mood was one of hope, having moved from despair to one of hope and an understanding that big challenges could be tackled. And secondly, there was a lot of shared sacrifice during that period. And obviously, it would not be literally true to say that everybody had the same experience, but everybody had the same ration cards, and at least in principle, therefore, you know, everybody was going through the same kinds of privations during that period. And so there was a much greater sense of solidarity as well. So if you're in a, if you have a zeitgeist of hope and solidarity, then your thought is, well, you know, if there's a challenge, yes, we can do it together. If your national mood is the opposite, it's a mood of fear and it's a mood of isolation because you've had 30 or 40 years of being told that rugged self-reliance is the way to go. And, you know, if you want your children to be rich, well, you need to make sure they work hard and study hard and get a good job, and it's down to them and it's not really down to anybody else for them to be successful. If you're in that isolationist mood and you're fear-ridden, then you feel, then it resonates with you when somebody says, no, we just can't afford to do this. You know, people who want to be successful will just have to make it on their own. And that was one of the things that was scariest for me when I realized that it's not just misinformation, it's actually that we've got a zeitgeist which makes this more difficult.
So, Mark, the book's out Thursday. How can people find out more, though?
Well, they don't even have to wait till Thursday, because the website, 99%percent.org, is open now, and it will tell people a lot about the book, and it will also tell them how they can get involved, how they can find out more, and how they can help to be part of the change that ends mass impoverishment.
But the book itself, published by Head of Zeus, is out this Thursday. It's called 99% Mass Impoverishment and How We Can End It. And Mark E. Thomas was our special guest this morning, for which we're very grateful. You heard him here on Talk Radio, the talk of the nation.